There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day and thanks for dialing up Democracy Sausage. I'm Mark Kenny from ANU's Australian Studies Institute and indeed the School of Politics and International Relations. And this podcast is made possible by policyforum.net at the Crawford School of Public Policy. So very much a collaboration. On Democracy Sausage, we sometimes look back and sometimes forward, but the program this week actively does both. Just don't tell the 100-year-old Chinese Communist Party, which regards history itself as a battleground, a tool of the present in which truth is merely one option. Indeed, it's an offence to challenge the party's version of history with pesky facts like the number of people massacred at Tiananmen Square in 1989 or enslaved in Xinjiang province right now. President Xi's truth is the only truth. Alternative accounts are described as historical nihilism. Xi says that history has chosen the Chinese Communist Party, just as the people have chosen the Chinese Communist Party. 50 years ago this week, Australia's then opposition leader, Gough Whitlam, travelled to China's capital, then called Peking, to establish contact and begin the formal recognition of China. The CCP was 50 years old exactly. It was an audacious act from the opposition, yet it would be followed immediately by a secret mission from the Nixon White House to do the same thing. 50 years later, and the CCP is, of course, 100 years old this very week. Australia led the process of bringing China into the world with active engagement and now seems to be leading the process of renunciation of Beijing's policies. To discuss the multiple issues involved here, I'm joined by Dr. David Goodman, who is Emeritus Professor of Chinese Politics at the University of Sydney, and whose research interests include contemporary social and political change in China and the history of the aforementioned Chinese Communist Party. And it's welcome back also to Yun Zheng, who is Managing Editor of the China Story blog at ANU and produces the weekly newsletter China Nei Kan. She's a former policy advisor in the departments of Prime Minister and Cabinet, Treasury and Defence. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Hello.
David, the first meeting of the Chinese Communist Party was a conclave of sorts in Shanghai in 1921, hence 100 years ago. Can you just sort of set the tone of that meeting? Tell us a little bit about the history of that event.
Well, I mean, before we go any further, we should really recognise that the nomination of the 1st of July, or even, in fact, July 1921 as the foundation of the Communist Party, is part of the creation of history, perfectly justified, but nonetheless a creation. The party had begun its life party in China had begun its life in a number of small groups in 1919 and 1920. And it was the Comintern, the Communist International, operating out of Petersburg, had sent its agents to China to organize the Communist Party at that time. So what happened in 1920 and then in 1921 is that various of these different groups who were around the country, some of whom were organized by the Comintern and some of whom were not, came together. And in fact, they probably met as such round about the 23rd of July rather than the 1st. But later on, it was decided that for reasons more or less of geomancy, that's to say the magic of numbers, that the 1st of July would be chosen as the date of the foundation of the party. And everybody agreed it. I mean, it wasn't like the party kind of casually did it. There was a lot of discussion in 1938 and again in 1941, and they agreed that this would be the date that it would be celebrated. So in Chinese, the word for 1st of July is not actually, well, it's sometimes called Party Day, but it's more likely to be Commemoration Day. So not necessarily the day on which it happened, but the day on which we commemorate.
Well, as I mentioned, the Chinese Communist Party can be criticized for its rather elastic application of truth and dogma and so forth. But I think we can afford them some license for messing around with the dates. I mean, over 100 years, a matter of 3 weeks. And
I think your criticism is far too harsh. History is not what happened. History is what we say now happened in the past.
Yes.
And whilst it's true that communist parties, as a rule, say thing, you know, you can say of communist parties as a rule that it's the future is always certain. It's only the past which is changing. Nonetheless, everybody does this. Everybody, every society in the world creates its society. Just look at the British, right? The British create a history that goes back to Boadicea. In fact, you know, they created themselves in the 19th century. It's a load of hogwash. Communist parties, though, do it more. And, of course, President Xi has been to the fore recently with his comments on historical nihilism. But it's not unusual.
Well, look, this is called Democracy Sausage, after all. You're allowed to express views, and it's fantastic that you do. And two, that's really the point, that it's not so much about what your version of history is. It's about whether you're allowed to have an alternative version. That is a fairly critical difference.
I totally agree with you. As an author who's written about things that the party on occasions doesn't seem to agree with, I've been in situations where I've had to defend my views, both outside China and, incidentally, inside China. So I totally agree with you.
So this meeting anyway, this conclave that occurred, whether it was later in July or whatever, and as you say, it's often difficult to pin down the creation of lots of things that go on to become, whether it be businesses or political parties or other creative ideas, it can be difficult anyway to pin down the precise moment at which something could be said to have actually come into being. But nonetheless, it's important that, as you say, there was a representative of the Comintern there, and that this happens really in the shadow of the Russian Revolution as well. So that really tells us a lot about what was going on internationally and what influence that had, and I suppose in the way that the sort of Marxist-Leninist ideology informed the creation of the CCP.
Completely correct. Some of the Marxists were independent of Comintern and some were not. But you would say that the early days of the party were very much structured by Moscow, Petersburg and the Soviet Revolution. No question about it.
And a lot of people back then also studied overseas. Quite a few studied in France as well. So even in early days, there are a lot of foreign influences in the establishment of the CCP, which is quite interesting now because right now the CCP likes to talk about how it does not like foreign influence, but really the CCP was established with a lot of foreign influence.
Yes, indeed. It does seem to be somewhat more insular now than perhaps was the case in the past. Is there a generally good understanding, do you think, in the West about the origins of the Chinese Communist Party, the influences that happen? I mean, we know of, obviously, the major figures like Mao Zedong. He doesn't become the leader until 1935, so that's, you know.
Or even later, yeah.
Is it later?
Sometime between 1935 and 1942, yeah.
And why is, I mean, it's interesting, we're having a discussion a minute ago about, you know, the timing of a meeting, you know, over a matter of weeks, and then something as critical as who is the leader, you say is in fact a little less determinant over a period of years.
Well, historians argue over this.
Okay.
And the reason is that the nominal position of leader wasn't his until much later.
Right, I see.
So he had more emphasis. I mean, take Deng Xiaoping, for example, in later time. Deng Xiaoping was never the number one leader by name, but he was regarded as the paramount leader. And so, you know, influence is everything. It's not a liberal democracy, remember.
Yes, we keep reminding ourselves of that. But I'm really quite fascinated by that. So is that because the positions that, and, you know, we'll come to Xi Jinping, obviously, in more detail, but is that because the positions that he now holds as leader of the party, what is he, Secretary General of the Chinese Communist Party?
Who?
Xi Jinping.
Yeah, and President of the PRC.
Yeah. Now, obviously, President of the PRC couldn't exist at that time because the PRC hasn't come into being yet.
Correct.
But is that one of the reasons?
There was a General Secretary of the party before 49, and there was also a chair of the party. And in fact, there were many different strands, which we might call factions,
right,
in the Communist Party before about 1945. And it included people who were like Mao. They were peasant revolutionaries who'd gone to the countryside in 1927. There were people who'd stayed in China after the defeat of 1927 when the nationalists turned on the communists. And there were also people who liked Mao and people who didn't like Mao. And there were people who liked each other and didn't like each other. There were people who'd been educated in Moscow, as Jun was saying, and who came back and said, with the backing of Moscow, they said things like, well, we're going to tell you how to run the revolution. And, of course, that didn't go on well either. There were even people who'd stayed in China and not gone to Moscow who hadn't been involved with Mao and had decided to do their own thing on the Long March. And they had their own group. And in fact, they were all around, even in Yan'an, which is where the party ended up in the late 1930s and early 1940s.
Right. And so just sort of getting an overall picture of this period, we're talking about essentially some very big forces that are in play. There's the war against the occupying Japanese state that is running China. So there's the War of Independence, what's not normally called that, but essentially
it's called the War of Resistance against Japan.
Yes.
We in Australia often call it the Second World War.
Yes.
And, of course, what we forget and what many Chinese people forget about that era in China is there was actually a Chinese government that sided with Japan. So the nationalists moved to Chongqing when the Japanese invaded after 1937. And the communists were in North China running their guerrilla war. But there was also a government in Nanjing and Wuhan under Wang Jingwei that was siding with Japan. It was one of Japan's colonial governments like they'd had in Manchuria.
But this is not Chiang Kai-shek.
No, this is not Chiang Kai. Chiang Kai-shek was in Chongqing.
Right.
This is another guy altogether. And they were in the central southeastern part of China.
A very controversial figure and remains
a very controversial figure, and his wife too. I've just been living in, this is a tangent, but I've just been living for the last few years, last decade in Suzhou. And Wang Jingwei's wife lived in Suzhou whilst he was running the government. And they had a residence in Suzhou too. Anyhow, be that as it may.
And so the Japanese are eventually expelled.
Yes.
And then we have the communists moving on the nationalists. We have what is effectively a kind of a civil war. And that's when eventually the nationalists are defeated. Chiang Kai-shek takes the nationalist forces to Taiwan. It's really interesting when you look at sort of a telescoping of these events, the extent to which they frame things that people understand about China now, the tension with Japan, the tension with Taiwan, the premium that is placed by the Chinese Communist Party on the reunification of Greater China, including obviously the reabsorption of Taiwan. David?
Mark, I would also add that the party's experience in running guerrilla warfare in the late 30s and early 1940s is crucial to understanding its organizational way of doing things after 1949 and right up to the present.
Right up to that's an interesting observation. And can you expand on that?
Yeah, well, all the ideology, all the development of the mass line and how they organize things and how they explain things dates from that period. But on top of that, the administrative, the organizational way of recruiting cadres, of appointing cadres, of the party looking after government dates from that period. And it's very much based on what was developed in Yan'an and in North China at that time. Also, I think, and Jun will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the intolerance of leaders like Deng Xiaoping for democracy which is not generated from the top down, in other words, democracy which comes from the bottom up, is at least to some extent the result of that period. Because here was the party moving into the countryside, mobilizing people who they thought were largely uneducated. And so the benefit of telling them what to do is very obvious. You know, you don't get many peasants telling you, when you say to them in 1939, you shouldn't do that, you don't get peasants saying, no, we won't do that. Indeed, many years later, when I did social science research work in peasant North China, people still said to me things like, when I said to them, how was the revolution? They would still say to me, excuse me, what are you talking about? What revolution? You know, this is the way we do things. We obey our landlords. We obey people who own the land. We do what we're told.
Jun, that's a really interesting point, isn't it? This idea that the Chinese Communist Party is coming to power as a military force, and the way it has run that revolution is absolutely informs its mentality now and is translated into, you know, a much more sophisticated and extraordinary economy than it is now. And yet a lot of that kind of thinking still inculcates the logic of the party knowing best.
Oh, yes. It's a matter of a continuity and change, right? The history is continuous, but it also changes. CCP back then was a revolutionary party, but now it has to act as a ruling party. And for that to happen, it has to adapt to different circumstances and changing world power balances as well. And just before that, when we're talking about the war of resistance against Japan, another interesting thing that I have found is that over the last, say, 20 years or so, how the CCP portrays its role and the role of nationalists fighting in the war of resistance against Japan has changed quite significantly. I think partly due to how it perceives Taiwan. Perhaps that's one of the reasons why now it emphasizes more of a role for nationalists, whereas before, I remember when I was in China, basically the standard narrative was the CCP was doing all the fighting and nationalists were the ones that did nothing at all. So you can see even in the short period of time how history has really changed.
In fact, the reverse was said to be the case, wasn't it? That the nationalists were very depleted by the war of resistance against the Japanese, and the communists had stayed out of a lot of it, had been cloistered up in the north.
Certainly, if you look at casualty numbers, more people have definitely died in the. I mean, it was the regular army. The nationalists were the Chinese military, basically. They were the ruling government. So you would expect that they would do a lot of fighting, of course.
Well, if we're talking about who died in the war, of course, on both sides, by which I mean the Japanese and the Chinese sides, so nationalists and communists, most of the soldiers who died were not Japanese, but were Chinese, because most of the Japanese forces in China who were fighting in that period were actually Chinese mercenaries. Very, very few proportionately Japanese soldiers. And this has nothing to do with Wang Jingwei and the Chinese government. This is the soldiers who just signed up for the Japanese forces.
Yeah.
If the communists came into your county and organized against you and you were a landlord, you would switch often, not always, but often to the Japanese side. And your peasants would then join the soldiers who were fighting against the communists. That's what happened. Not everywhere. Not everywhere by any stretch of the imagination, but that certainly happened quite a lot.
It is also quite localized. Which military join often depends on where you happen to be. And so my grandfather actually joined the CCP army because he was from Shandong, and people from that region generally join the CCP. It doesn't really had nothing to do with ideology. But more to do with just where you came from.
So Mao dies in 1976, and we eventually see the rise of Deng Xiaoping, the aforementioned. And there is an adaptation then of Marxist ideology in that period. There is a sense that that China is going to modernize quite rapidly, and that does occur. But there are also some setbacks. And, of course, by 1989, we see the Tiananmen Square massacre, and there's a sort of global deflation of hope about the continuous liberalization of China.
To start off with, I discount very much the power of Marxist ideology, even under Mao. It had influence, of course, and it led him into some very interesting backwaters, particularly, for example, when he was talking about the bourgeoisie within the party in the late 1950s and early 1960s. But the crucial thing for me that starts with the foundation of the party is that this is about the nationalist, with a small n, regeneration of China. And Deng Xiaoping was not a minor figure in the party leadership before Mao's death. He was a major figure. And indeed, he was protected by Mao even during the Cultural Revolution when Mao attacked him. So, there's lots of paradoxes and ironies here. During the mid-1970s, or in fact, in the beginning in the mid-1950s, there was a debate about how China's socioeconomic development should be managed by the party. And this debate resurrected itself towards the end of the Cultural Revolution. And Deng played a leading role in that. And so when Mao died and the Gang of Four, Mao's widow and her supporters, were removed from office in October 1976, there was a kind of inevitability that things would start to change. And Deng, it is sure, led that change. But he didn't lead it so much away from Marxism as towards economic regeneration and integration with the rest of the world. And that's crucial. So I think that side of things is crucial. The other thing where I would take issue with your use of words and what you were saying was the expectation that China was going to liberalize. I'm not sure I understand what that means. If by that you mean China would become a liberal democracy, that was a false expectation even then. If you mean that China might open up, well, to a large extent, it has done. Despite everything that's happened in the last 10 years, which is there are some ways in which we might see a winding back. Nonetheless, the economy has changed its structure. It has become more open. The failure of openness is that the party is still obsessed with control. And that dampens innovation. It creates fear. It reinforces fear as a driver of people's behavior. And that's not good for an open society. I mean, I could say, obviously, a lot more, but I don't want to hog the conversation.
I'm enjoying your thoughts.
Forgive me, Mark.
Well, I absolutely appreciate your thoughts there. And I'm going to get Jun to respond and to say a few things as well. But I'm going to take a quick break first, just because we need to do so, and we'll come back and continue the conversation.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, June, just before the break, David was talking, taking issue to some extent with some of the characterisations that I'd made about expectations of liberalisation, whether that amounted to it becoming a full liberal democracy or not is another matter. I don't think I was suggesting that, but some people may have had that hope. Certainly there was a hope that with increasing development, there would be the growth of the middle class, they would demand more freedoms, we would see some institutional norms created around those freedoms, and that this would, you know, lead to a more liberal society. Would it be absolutely liberal? I don't think that was necessarily in people's imaginations, but for a time it did seem to be moving in some of those directions. And we see things like by 2001, the membership of the World Trade Organization, for example, as China is coming into the world, agreeing to play by those rules. So, you know, there's some continuity here in some of these things that were fueling these hopes.
Yes, there's certain continuity, and there certainly has been hopes throughout early CCP history for liberalization as well. I think even during Yan'an times, there was a lot of debate about, you know, can we allow artists and literatis more freedom? Unfortunately, that was struck down, and many literary people who argued for more liberalizing influences was basically, some of them were actually tortured. And then after that, there was a 100 Flowers Bloom campaign, but then that then turns into enticing the snakes out of their holes, and then they were again struck down. So throughout early CCP history, there has been successive rounds, almost endless rounds of purges, after purges, where people first had hope and then they got crushed. And when we look at Deng Xiaoping, he's actually a survivor. He is a survivor of so many purges. It's a miracle when you think about it, how someone can really, after so many purges, first you get struck down and then get elevated again and get struck down again, to really somehow still achieve, and in the end, I guess, great leadership, being a leader of the CCP. And that is quite amazing. Although now I think there is also a debate about his actual influence. There's also people saying that Hua Guofeng, who succeeded Mao, had a more of a role to play in opening up the country than what Deng Xiaoping did. But of course, Deng Xiaoping becoming a paramount leader means his role was elevated. But interestingly, now that Xi has come into power, under Xi, we are seeing that Deng's role is again being de-emphasized, whereas Mao's role in the CCP has again been emphasized. And we should really think about why Xi would want to do that. Perhaps it is one explanation is that Xi wants to be more like Mao, being more centralizing power, more of a force for centralization and less force for liberalization, as the common narrative holds for Deng Xiaoping.
That's a really interesting point. What's your response to that, David? Is it possible that this is driven a lot by ego? I mean, the great figure of the Chinese Revolution is Mao Zedong. Why wouldn't Xi Jinping want to be essentially, you know, put him and Mao on the same pedestal and leave all the rest of them out of it? Is it as simple as that, or is there some deeper ideological or control logic to this?
It's something that's concerned me for the last decade, really. I thought at the beginning, when Xi Jinping seemed to be developing what other people might describe as a personality cult, I thought this was because he needed to remove strong contenders to his position in the leadership of the party. But he is still continuing to do that. And it's really, for me, it's really interesting that he hasn't moved against not the people who are in the party leadership, but the families who control the wealth of China. There would be a reason for wanting to have all that concentrated personal power if you were going to do something with it other than...
More of the same.
More of the same, yeah. And there are two key goals, it seems to me, for the leader of the CCP at the moment. One is to maintain the rule of the Communist Party, and the other is to keep the economy growing. Because if you don't do those two things, you're finished. I don't understand why the extent of his personality cult, where it comes into this, because The one thing we know from history, you'll forgive me for using this given that I criticized history before, but the one thing we know from the past is that if you have a somebody who is personalist and stays around for a long time, the successor problem becomes enormous. Who is going to succeed Xi Jinping? It will become a tremendous problem. There is, you know, the lack of procedures for that now compared to 10 years ago are really quite considerable. So I think, you're in danger. You're not going to jeopardize the whole project. But if you continue going down this path and there's a financial crisis or an economic crisis in China, you've got a real problem. So I don't understand it at all. Maybe Jun knows. You know anybody who knows Xi Jinping? I don't know anybody who knows Xi Jinping.
No, unfortunately, I don't have high enough contacts.
But you were talking, I would like to come back to this issue of what people say and what they do.
Yes.
Because I think for me, there's a really important point in this that, we were talking about the Communist Party's Marxism, we were talking about their attitude to democracy and so on. I want to quote you something from 1941. And tell me if you know who said this, Jun. It's this. This is 1941. This is a major Communist Party leader. We communists always oppose a one-party dictatorship. The Communist Party of China certainly doesn't have a program to monopolize government, because one party can only rule in its own interests and won't act according to the will of the people. Moreover, it goes against democratic politics. Who do you think said that?
Mao Zedong?
No, Deng Xiaoping, 1941. Now, you've got to unpack it and understand where it comes from. This is when they were trying to form local governments of resistance to the Japanese in the War of Resistance. And they were actually setting up government systems. And so they were saying, yes, we are in favor of these things. Why don't they do that after 49? Because the rule is the party is looking to maintain its position. It's not there for liberal democratic purposes. It could, if it wanted to, have more openness under the mass line, under the notion of democratic centralism, but it chooses not to. That's my simple point.
The party actually talks a lot about democracy throughout its history.
It does
indeed.
And it
actually talks, more recently, democracy means democracy under the CCP. But during early party times, it talked a lot about multi-party. But, when you become the ruling party, then you want to hold on to rule.
It's a tactic. That's because it's a tactic. And we shouldn't forget where the ideas of contemporary ideas of democracy come from. They don't come from ancient Greece. They come from the French Revolution. And in the French Revolution, there were two very different views of democracy. One was what we now call liberal democracy. And the other is what we might, if we chose to call totalitarian democracy, but which is well represented as democratic centralism. It's where the party knows what's in the interests of the people. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not a manifest notion of democracy in the people themselves, but the party interpreting the interests of the people for the people. And that's democratic centralism.
Yes, right. Well, I'm glad we don't quite have that in this country at this stage. But we do have it on this podcast.
Not yet. Wait for it.
To Jun's point about the party talking a lot about democracy, though, I'm reminded of there was an episode of Yes Minister where it's explained to young Bernard at one point that the less you intend to do about something, the more you need to talk about it. And another law was always deal with the difficult part in the title. So whenever you're making a report, you can put it in the title and then you don't have to refer to it again. And of course, there have been plenty of countries around the world that have called themselves the Democratic Republic of this or that. There's the DPRK, for example.
Well, if you don't mind me saying so, we have a Conservative Party that calls itself a Liberal Party.
Yes.
Not that hang up on words.
Yes, that's very true. That's very true. Let's talk about Xi Jinping, though, because you know, he comes to power, he becomes leader for life in 2018. Before that, he's begun the process of building these islands in the South China Sea, much to the chagrin of the international community, particularly Australia, but the West generally. Is he a different leader from not just what we thought when he arrived, but has he in fact changed since the time that he arrived as the leader of China to what he is now? Have we seen a change in Xi Jinping over that time? He's become more autocratic, taken more control, brooked fewer other voices or possibilities or rivals for leadership, as you were touching on, David. Do you think he's changed?
Shall I let you do an answer first?
If we're only looking at after he took power, I don't think he has changed, because even during his early times under his Xi's rule, he was quite authoritarian already. We can see he has authoritarian tendencies through his anti-corruption drives, his ways to ensure loyalty to him, mm-hmm. and also get rid of rivals, right? Now, that's pretty common for a new leader. From then, our expectations of him hasn't really changed. What has changed is before he took power, people thought that he would go continue the lines of economic reform, continue the line of perhaps a little bit more freedom for people to dissent. And since he has come into power, that kind of expectation has been shattered. We are seeing there's definitely a lot more control. There's a lot more crushing of dissent. People have been got into trouble, have been jailed for what they say, more so than under previous rulers, perhaps. In that sense, he hasn't really changed after he took power, but he has revealed himself more to be more of a authoritarian ruler. And the one thing that has perhaps surprised a lot of people is a change of constitution. The term limit was imposed for a reason, because the CCP realized there is danger in a cult of personality. There is a danger in having someone ruling for so long, as Mao has done. So it has been a surprise to a lot of people that the such term limits were removed.
David?
I think it would be dangerous to equate Xi Jinping's one-person rule with Mao's one-person rule for the following reasons. Mao was somebody who came up through the ranks and was proved to be right in the strategy and tactics of the revolution when those around him were proved wrong. And he developed a group of people who worked with him and who, as the years went on, strove to do what he wanted, even when it wasn't easy to understand it. You only have to look at the history of the 50s and early 60s to see that even in the birth of the Cultural Revolution, when Mao turned on the party, there were people like Liu Shaoqi and Deng Xiaoping who were the major opponents, presented as the major resistance to the Cultural Revolution, who actually were trying to do what he wanted. So that was the situation. Mao's authority was based on charisma. That's the source of his legitimacy, for having done the right thing for so long and people wanting to revolve around him. Xi Jinping isn't like that. Xi Jinping came up again through the ranks, but he came up through the ranks of an established party state. You know, he ran for office, as it were, on merit, on doing what he did. Did he have a group of people around him? Well, he clearly did. And that's my point. He is the figurehead, but he isn't absolute in his power the way that Mao was. If he really annoyed the people who support him in the leadership, he could conceivably be removed. How do we see Xi Jinping controlling the levers of state, of security, of intelligence, of domestic intelligence, in quite the way that Mao did? I don't. I think there are other people who are involved there, and they have interests, including, as I alluded to before, the very important economic interests. People don't have to be independent capitalists to have economic interests in the party state. You asked a question before about the middle class.
Yep.
Don't forget that the middle class in China is not independent of the party state. It is an essential, there is a growing and small professional middle class who might be seen to be independent of the party state, but most of the middle class are an inherent part of the party state. It's a big difference to a liberal democracy.
And certainly, most people join the CCP for career advancement and not because of ideology. And so you do, especially since, I think, was Jiang's times, you do see a lot of people that is in the middle class as a managerial level or professional level that's in the CCP.
Jun is absolutely right. I had colleagues in Suzhou who were very disappointing in the way the Communist Party had gone, because they were members and they wanted more Marxism, not less.
Yes. Well, while we're on the subject of Marxism and class, I mean, Marxism is based around class and the idea of the proletariat's responsibility to rise up, to seize control from their oppressors and from the capitalist class. Tell me, how does the modern Chinese Communist Party reconcile this question of class against the vast wealth of some individuals? There are now more billionaires in Beijing than there are in New York, fractionally. The economy is obviously going gangbusters, but the disparity between the richest and the poorest in China is absolutely huge, of course. How does the Chinese Communist Party explain this to its own people?
Well, the first thing is, you know, Deng said, let some people get rich first and other people will follow. Unfortunately, that does not seem to have happened. So what the CCP has done is that it does co-opt the labor unions, for example. So all the unions in China is part of the CCP. There is no independent union that you can find. And if you were an independent organizer of labor, a labor organizer, you will get harassed by the CCP and sometimes put in jail. And quite interestingly, one of the biggest critics of the Chinese Communist Party and one of its biggest source of threat is actually from Marxists. There's a Marxist on campus that's quite agitating for labor rights, and they are seen as more of a threat to the Chinese Communist Party than really an ally. So how does Chinese Communist Party then square with that? I guess one thing that it has done recently is its anti-poverty campaigns. So the party came to power on the basis of rural peasants supporting the party and the workers supporting the party, and has always promised these sections of the country benefits. But what we've seen throughout history is that it's always the peasants that suffer the most. It suffers through the Great Leap Forward and the famine and the Cultural Revolution. Peasants are the ones that's always suffering. But now under Xi Jinping, it has promised that it has eliminated poverty, that finally it has fulfilled the promise of what it has came to do. It has eliminated poverty, and now it has turned its attention to getting more benefits for people that live in rural areas. I guess that's just a way for them to always sell hope. You want people to have hope. Unfortunately, hope amongst people in China are declining, but the Chinese Communist Party is trying to get people to become more hopeful for the future.
David, your thoughts on that question of how the party reconciles this argument?
I don't agree about lack of hope in China. I mean, my experience living in China in the last decade has been that people are very positive about the regime. I'm equally as pessimistic as Jun and you about equality. I mean, I think equality is an appalling problem. Inequality is an appalling problem in China. And were the party to be serious about decreasing inequality, it would introduce a redistributive tax system, probably abolish household registration between rural and urban as well. Now, it's not done that, and it's not planning to do that. It's planning to fund government spending not through taxation, but through the profits of enterprises. That seems to me entirely the wrong way to go about creating a sustainable economic growth, but that's a different matter. Now, how does the party justify the role of the proletariat in its vision? Well, of course, it's always had that problem, because that particular ideology came out of Europe at the end of the 19th century and was all about capitalism, about capitalists versus workers in an industrial situation. And much of China has never had that kind of economic geography. So from the beginning, it was always going to be hard to have that kind of revolution and that kind of political movement, which is why, of course, 1927 was and the attempted revolution in the towns by the party was such a failure. After that, the party reinterpreted the role of the proletariat as the role of the workers and peasants, and it's done that consistently ever since. And it still does that. And it says, you know, it's a proletarian revolution because we stand for the peasants and workers and the people of China. And that's how it presents itself. It's not true, of course, that whilst the rich have got richer, the poor have got poorer. They haven't. On the whole, the poor have also got wealthier. It's just the rich have got stinking rich. And the wealth of the country is not equally shared. And so the exploitation of peasants and workers is quite horrific. At the end of the 1990s, when the state decided to move away from a large degree of state-owned enterprise management, it laid off about 60 million urban workers, a huge proportion of the urban workforce. And many of those people and their families still have poverty-like situations. They've been unable to find work. It's replaced the proletariat, the urban proletariat, with a new category of the working class, the migrant workers who come in from the countryside, who do not have welfare benefits in urban areas, who sometimes don't have the right to live, and who suffer in consequence. So the working class is really, the new working class, the new migrant working class, is really a precariat, which is quite a staggering phenomena in a communist party state.
Yes, precisely. You would have thought it's one of the reasons for being.
Well, it's not true. Of course, I would be unfair if I said that the party state wasn't trying to introduce policies to ameliorate the situation of those social categories. But it's a very slow process, and it isn't putting as much resources into it as it's putting into some other things.
Much slower than that wealth accumulation. I just want to finish on a question to you both, noting that Stephen Fitzgerald, who had accompanied Whitlam to Peking back in 1971 in that famous visit, and then was named as Australia's first ambassador there, he's joined the chorus of criticism, I suppose, about Australia's approach to China now, diplomatically speaking. He cites countries like Japan, Vietnam, South Korea and Singapore who have historical grievances with China but who have maintained some level of back-channel dialogue. They've got sort of multi-level communication going on. I just wonder whether you could both speak to that, whether we have done too much publicly and not enough privately and left ourselves exposed here.
Well, I definitely think that. I retired this March, just gone, came back to Sydney, came back to a world I didn't recognise of conflict between China and Australia, open conflict. And I've been trying to understand what's going on when ministers get up in public and say, well, our calls to our counterparts in Beijing are not being answered. Well, of course they're not. If you go in for megaphone diplomacy, they're not going to be answered. What you need to do is have, as Stephen says, the back talk. You need to have your people talk to their people, and it's not impossible. Other countries do it. We certainly should be doing it. The reason we're not doing it is because we're being a kind of sheriff to the United States in the region. And I don't understand it. What do we have to gain from alienating China? What do we have to gain? I mean, there are things we should be standing up for in criticizing China. I'm not arguing about that. But at the same time, we have a lot to gain from interaction with China. And in my view, the sensible way to do it would be to make your criticisms known to China at the same time as you engage with China. But standing up with a megaphone and going out on a lead to criticize China for actually some things they may not even be responsible for, like COVID-19, this doesn't make any sense to me. I mean, they may be responsible for it. Please don't misunderstand me, but they may not be. And if you don't know, don't shout it in public.
Interesting point. Jun?
Well, Australia is a middle power. But I think the problem is the government tends to forget that, and we like to act as if we are a great power. We like to say things like, oh, you know, we should do whatever we want without suffering any consequences, basically. But Australia is a middle power, what we should be doing is to really band together with other middle powers and not really stick our heads out unnecessarily. Because that's actually, you know, this is what great power does. The United States can go and confront China. That's fine. They're both great powers, but Australia is not. So we should really work with our allies, partners, you know, like-minded countries, as they say in diplomacy, and to ensure, to be clear what our interests are and to really pursue our interests through working with in multilateral organizations, international forums, other countries to pursue our national interest.
There are so many ways in which we could take this discussion further, and I've really thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope our listeners have enjoyed it too. Jun Zheng and David Goodman, thanks for being with us on this Democracy Sausage, marking both the 100th anniversary of the CCP and the 50th anniversary of that famous visit by Gough Whitlam back in 1971. So thanks again to both of you for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
I'm Mark Kenny. Let's talk again next week. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.